It's all over at the state capitol. Lawmakers banged the gavel on their session early this morning. It ended earlier than normal, a lot earlier.
We have not had a session that's been this short since before man walked on the moon.
I'm Mark Brody. Today on the show, what got done and what didn't survive the session's final day. Also, APS hopes to raise solar rates, again. Bark beetles have a new enemy. Why some Jews are making a Passover pilgrimage to the Valley. And our trip up Central Avenue continues with a stop in Midtown.
I think there's a really cool throwback to, times when we were growing up, when you knew your neighbors, when your kids played together, when they played down the street. And I think there's a lot of neighborhoods really missing that. And this neighborhood has that.
Plus, we seek out another Valley hot corner and poetry at the museum. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Quick check of Valley traffic. 60 westbound, there's an accident at Mill that has three lanes blocked. Also on I-10 eastbound, an accident blocks the shoulder at 16th Street. Sunny skies should remain in the forecast for the next little while. Look for a high today of 88. Sunny weekend on the way as well, with a high of 91 tomorrow, down to 89 on Sunday. It's sunny and 84 degrees right now at KJZZ. The Hopi tribe has lost another legal battle in its push to have the U.S. cover the costs of bringing safe drinking water to the reservation. As KJZZ's Kerry Young reports, that ruling came down from a federal circuit court of appeals on Thursday.
The dispute surrounds the quality of the drinking water on the reservation, much of which is groundwater. According to the tribe, the water system that serves five of its communities contains unsafe levels of arsenic. Tribal officials say because the U.S. funded and provided technical assistance for the construction of those wells, the federal government should pay to bring in a newer, safer source of water. The tribe also argued that not providing an adequate supply of drinking water is a breach of trust duties. In 2013, the Court of Federal Claims dismissed that complaint, saying the tribe did not prove the U.S. has a fiduciary obligation to provide safe drinking water to the reservation. This week, a federal circuit court of appeals affirmed that decision. Kerry Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Air Force plans to use 16 small sites in six southern Arizona counties for training to practice rescue missions. Officials at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base in Tucson have released a supplemental environmental assessment of 20 sites in Cochise, Gila, Graham, Pima, Pinal, and Santa Cruz counties. The state legislature adjourned sine die early this morning, right around 3:30. The House said goodbye. Joining me to talk about the session that just ended is Jim Small, editor of the Arizona Capital Times. How much coffee do you have last night?
Quite a bit. You know, there's a lot of caffeine floating around the legislature.
So what was the scene like last night? The Senate adjourned well before the House, which is unusual, and it seems like there was sort of a lot of back and forth, a lot of last-minute wrangling going on.
Yeah, so, I mean, the last day of session is always one of those days where there's a lot to do and a lot of waiting to do a lot of stuff. But this was a sine die, I think, for the ages. This one had a number of things we'd never seen before. I think most especially was the fact that, like you said, the Senate ended 2.5 hours earlier than the House did. They basically got sick and tired. They said, we've done all the voting we're going to do. All we have to do is wait for stuff to come back from the House. They decided, you know what? We're not going to stick around here forever waiting for these bills. We're just going to go home because the House isn't responding to our request to speed things up. So at about 1 o'clock in the morning, they made the motion to sine die, and they sent their people home, which basically means, well, guess what? The Senate's done. Yeah, you know, they took their ball and went home. So that the House was in the middle of debating a bill on the floor. When this happened, they were in the middle of voting on a bill, and at that point, it turned into chaos.
So what was left undone? I mean, what didn't happen this session that people maybe thought would happen?
Quite a few things, actually, that died on the final day. I think the one that they were debating when the Senate motion to sine die was this proposal that would have outlawed what critics call ballot harvesting, or this practice of collecting early ballots, having volunteers go out, collect early ballots that have been voted but haven't been mailed in, haven't been cast yet, and taking them, you know, in large numbers down to county elections officials. One of the other things that died was Governor Ducey's push to create an office of the Inspector General. That was something that he had talked about in the State of the State speech, and it had made a very late appearance in the session, probably about 3 or 4 weeks ago. It kind of popped up in a committee, got through the committee, but really struggled to get further than that. There just was not an appetite among senators to push this thing forward, at least not without taking a closer look at it and really considering the best way to do it rather than pushing this policy through quickly.
What are some of the big issues that did get approved yesterday? The House and Senate each voted on a lot of bills. What are some of the notable ones that made it through on the final day?
I think the two biggest ones were both things that Governor Ducey was actually supporting and pushing for. One was the creation of a real idea, a federally approved identification card for Arizonans that would essentially allow Arizonans to travel on commercial airlines without having to take a passport with them. The other thing is the governor pushing to get rid of the Department of Weights and Measures.
This was obviously Governor Ducey's first session. There were a lot of new members of leadership in both the House and Senate on both the Democratic and Republican sides. How would you say that the session went overall? I mean, it's obviously one of the shorter ones in recent memory, but how did it go?
Well, speedy. I mean, fast is definitely, I think, the word that jumps to mind. We have not had a session that's been this short since before man walked on the moon. It was 1968 was the last time we had a session. We finished in 81 days this year. That was a testament, I think, to the fact that you had Governor Ducey who came in and really made it a priority. He did not want to have a drawn-out legislative session, certainly not for his first session.
Jim Small is editor of the Arizona Capital Times. Jim, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Arizona Public Service is proposing raising its rates for new solar customers. It's the latest Arizona utility to target solar customers this year. KJZZ's business correspondent, Christina Hansen, joins me to explain what this means. Hi, Christina.
Hi there.
So what is APS proposing?
So APS filed a request with the Arizona Corporation Commission this week for permission to increase the rate that solar customers pay for electricity. It would come to about $21 on average per month per customer, and it only applied to new solar customers.
So is this similar to the net metering debate from back in 2013?
Yes, it is. Right now, there's a $5 monthly fee on average on APS's solar customers, which was approved by the Corporation Commission in 2013 during that very heated net metering debate. And actually, the $21 solar fee that APS is proposing today is what the commission determined was appropriate back in 2013, but it ultimately opted for $5 with the idea of gradually raising it in the future as more people go solar.
Well, how does this compare to the solar fees that Salt River Project approved earlier this year?
It's similar, but there are some differences. For example, both apply only to new solar customers, but SRP's solar fee comes to about $51 extra per month on average, depending on usage. So APS's proposal is much smaller. And SRP's solar fee was approved as part of its rate increase for all its customers, while APS's proposal is focused entirely on solar customers.
Why does APS say it needs to do this?
Well, utilities in general argue that solar customers create what's called a cost shift, meaning solar customers produce their own energy, which is why they have lower energy bills. But most of the time, they still need to be hooked up to the grid when the sun's down. So utilities say solar customers aren't paying their fair share for accessing the grid, which ultimately shifts costs to non-solar customers. In this case, APS was expected to raise its solar fee as part of its next rate case this year, just like SRP did earlier this year. But APS's spokesman, Jim McDonald, says the rate case got pushed back to next year, and they just can't wait that long.
In 2014, we had a record number of rooftop solar installations, and so that's a growing issue that needs to be resolved. Letting it go another 2 years before the rate case would be settled at the earliest. By then, we'd have a cost shift that totals $800 million.
APS spokesman Jim McDonald. Christina, why are critics so concerned about this?
Well, the solar industry says these maneuvers by utilities like APS and SRP are just an attempt to discourage people from going solar to protect their own bottom lines. Court Rich, who's an attorney for the solar industry, says the cost shift argument hasn't been proven, which is what a rate hearing would do.
I think they believe that they have some sort of strategic advantage in this forum over a rate case. Because really, in a rate case, there would have to be a real examination, and there just hasn't been a real examination of the numbers, of whether or not what they're saying is even true. They've never had to introduce evidence and been subjected to, you know, cross-examination. There's been none of that.
That solar industry attorney, Court Rich. Christina, what's the next step and when might that happen?
Well, it's really up to the Corporation Commission at this point, but we could be looking at a few months before any final decision is made.
KJZZ's business correspondent, Christina Hansen. Christina, thanks.
Thank you.
Tonight marks the first night of the week-long Jewish holiday Passover, which begins with the traditional Seder meal. At the Seder, many Jews have a custom of saying by the time the holiday rolls around next year, they hope they'll be in Jerusalem. But in fact, many wind up right here in Arizona. As KJZZ's Jude Jaffe Block reports, the state is a destination for Passover-themed vacations.
The reason Passover vacations are so appealing is because if you're an observant Jew, it's a lot of work to prepare your home for the holiday. If you keep kosher, you already must have separate pots, plates, and utensils for meat and dairy. But when Passover rolls around,
you need double of everything, basically.
That's Arlen Bach. She keeps a kosher kitchen.
For Passover, the pots and pans that are dairy meat, Passover only. The silverware, dairy meat, Passover only. Dishes, Passover only. And then there's the foods that you can only eat and those that you can't eat.
I spoke with Bach at the Fairmont Scottsdale Princess Resort on a sunny patio next to a gently babbling fountain. This is how she'll spend Passover instead, along with her husband, an 18-year-old son, and their dog. The resort is a short drive from where they live.
Like, literally, it's been 20 years that we always go somewhere, and we just go because I got tired of staying in a kitchen, really. And you go to these programs, and there's food 24/7.
This year's menu includes rack of veal and beef short ribs. A rabbi from New York came to the resort 10 days ago to start the elaborate process of prepping the kitchen to make sure everything's kosher. And Bach gets to relax.
I load up my Kindle, and I bring books. I swim in the morning before it gets too crazy and crowded. And that's my day. I do nothing, basically, for 9 days. That's wonderful.
She'll be joined by more than 600 other Passover guests here, coming in from places like New York, L.A., and even Panama.
Hi, welcome, everybody.
Linda Clare greets guests as they trickle in on golf carts loaded down with luggage. She's with the New York-based company Presidential Kosher Holidays and spends much of her year planning this week.
This is our 16th year at the Scottsdale Princess, and I would say that we probably have some guests that are with us for 16 years here.
Claire's company also runs Passover vacations in Mexico and Miami. Some guests come with their entire extended families.
It's like a pop-up community for 10 days.
In addition to the resort activities, there's a camp for kids, a makeshift synagogue, and guest lectures. It's one of at least three Arizona resorts offering Passover vacations this year. Jude Jaffe Block, KJZZ News, Scottsdale.
Among the other guests coming to the Valley for Passover is Menachem Lubinsky. He's president and CEO of New York-based Lubicon Marketing, which specializes in the kosher market. Lubinsky has also done some research on the subject of Passover-themed programs.
It's been going on for almost 50 years, but not to the extent that it is today. I mean, perhaps maybe 10,000 people would go away maybe 20, 30 years ago. Today it's up to 60,000 people. And it's became a $140 million industry, and it has really caught on.
How did it get so big?
It got so big because the demand for upscale kosher dining became more prevalent. The whole idea of the kosher industry became more prevalent, and people wanted better things. And as the younger consumers came into the market, they were looking for something better. It kind of goes along with what happened in the kosher market with upscale restaurants, upscale caterers. And so the Passover programs kind of was a natural segue into that part of the industry.
So what are these programs like? I mean, for people who go to them, what do they do? What are they all about?
Okay, what they're all about is they celebrate the traditional Seders together with as many people that are there. There are programs of entertainment, of a Jewish song and music, of speakers that speak on various topics. Typically, there are also many programs for children and teens. So it's kind of like a resort, a vacation, melded into the spirituality of the holiday of Passover.
So how big of a market is Phoenix in the sort of realm of getting people to go away for Passover?
It is one of the major areas, I would say, that Florida, California, and Arizona are sort of the three primary locations. Although there are Passover programs today on cruises, there are Passover programs today in the Caribbean, there are Passover programs in Europe, and people look for these experiences because they're trying to sort of combine the tourist experience together with the Passover experience. But yes, Arizona and Phoenix and Scottsdale are very, very big and very major.
What's the range of how much these programs tend to cost?
These programs can range nationwide. I've done a survey on that. Can range anywhere from about $1,600 per person to well over $7,000 per person, depending on where the resort is and who the operator of the program is. I would say that the average is probably more like around $2,500. But remember, we're talking about 10 days in a hotel plus all meals, plus entertainment, so there is value, but obviously for someone who comes with a large family, it's a big ticket.
Is there competition among specific resorts or even among cities to try to get observant Jews to come to their particular program?
Yes. They begin advertising 8 months before Passover. Our estimate is there's approximately 125 resorts that operate these programs, but this year, almost all of them filled up. You know, for many, many housewives, the holiday of Passover is all about the liberation of the Jews from Exodus from Egypt. To them, this is a liberation that all they do is pack up and leave, lock up the homes and go away and be catered to and be fed. And so this is kind of like celebrating Passover in the best style.
Menachem Lubinsky is president and CEO of Lubicon Marketing. Menachem, thanks so much.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Still to come, polls have found concern about this country's moral standing, but what that means is up for debate.
Most people will agree in the abstract that killing is wrong, but then you get into the details of under what circumstances you can kill someone else.
That's ahead. It's the show. To the Valley Freeways now, a number of accidents, including I-10 eastbound at 59th Avenue, I-10 westbound at 35th Avenue, I-10 eastbound at 16th Street, the HOV lane is blocked there, and on the 60 westbound, there's a disabled vehicle at Mill blocking the center lane. Look for the partly sunny skies outside right now to continue for the rest of the day with a high of 88 degrees. 87 was our high yesterday. 82 is average. Clear skies tonight. Overnight lows in the low 60s. A sunny weekend on the way as well with a high of 91 tomorrow, 89 on Sunday. It's 84 degrees at KJZZ at 222.
KJZZ is supported by Mesa Arts Center. On April 7th, you can enjoy a beautiful evening under the stars with the Vincent Gardner Quartet, featuring wine, cheese, desserts, and both standards and original jazz. Tickets at mesaartscenter.com.
Neighborhoods really are the core of our city.
And when people come here, they see a stark difference from what they remember from decades ago.
The idea is that we are a melting pot of people who want urban living.
This neighborhood literally was born probably, I'd say, in a period of 5 years.
It's only 16 miles, but in some ways this one road encompasses a little bit of everything Phoenix has to offer. We've been driving up Central Avenue from South Mountain to North Mountain in our series Central, talking to people about their neighborhoods along the way. And today we can actually ditch the car. I'm standing on the platform at the light rail station at Encanto. We've reached the section of Central between McDowell and Bethany Home. Back in the day, this area was known for cruising, but today it's more about the train.
The idea is that we are a melting pot of people who want urban living.
Susan Thompson is president of the Midtown Museum Neighborhood District Association, which describes itself as committed to building community for those who work, live, and play in Midtown Phoenix.
I love sitting in my backyard and looking at the high rises, but I like having a yard. But I love being in the high rises to see the expanse of this beautiful valley. And that's also what's exciting, is that when you're in these buildings, you don't have other buildings butted up against you. You can't get that anywhere else.
If you drive or ride the light rail up Central, you can really see an era of Phoenix's history passing by, specifically the middle of the last century. In fact, Thompson and I joke that her neighborhood seems like the part of town in which Don Draper from the TV show Mad Men would be most likely to live.
I think we take a lot of pride in our mid-century modern buildings. We want to protect them and preserve them. Certainly, things like Mad Men have brought mid-century back to be a very hip sort of perspective. But I think what we like about mid-century modern, it was a period of possibility.
Thompson uses that word, possibility, a lot to describe Midtown. She sees it in older apartments and nearby high-rises.
Oh, my God. So you can't beat that. Come on.
Thompson says Midtown already has great views, but she also sees room for more galleries, homes, and a stronger restaurant presence. The kitchen at Federal Pizza is humming at lunchtime. It's one of four restaurants plus an ice cream shop within about a block of each other on Central, just north of Camelback from the company Upward Projects. Its founding partners, Craig DeMarco and Lauren Bailey, also have their offices there in the same building as Federal Pizza. It was designed by Al Beadle, a well-known mid-century architect. Bailey says having four historic neighborhoods around Central and Camelback made the area a very appealing place to open their restaurants. But she says it didn't always feel that way.
It was definitely a big risk. Craig and I sat in the front of Postino's parking lot and watched Circle K get robbed a couple times. And we were like, we're either really, really crazy and dumb, or this is going to be a great idea. So one or the other. And luckily, it was the latter.
Bailey and DeMarco's restaurants are housed in buildings that used to serve very different purposes. Federal Pizza, for example, is in the former First Federal Bank building. This concept of adaptive reuse is important to DeMarco and Bailey. They say reusing existing buildings helps connect with the community.
I think there's a really cool throwback to you know, times when we were growing up, when you knew your neighbors, when your kids played together, when they played down the street. And I think there's a lot of neighborhoods really missing that, and this neighborhood has that.
One of those throwback factors is the close proximity of homes to offices. There are high-rises of each along the stretch of Central. But just as residents left Phoenix's urban core in the past, employers did the same. Chris Mackey, Phoenix's Community and Economic Development Director, says some of the reasons were similar. The suburban areas were newer, closer to freeways. It felt more now, but that was then. While people are moving back into the heart of the city, businesses have been a little slower. Mackey hopes to change that.
These are grand, beautiful buildings, and people are taking another look at them. I think what's happening is the workforce wants to be in an urban environment. Where my generation wanted to be suburban, this generation wants to be urban, and that's causing these buildings to get a whole new look.
Mackey met me at the CenturyLink building on Thomas, about a block east of Central, with Jerry Roberts. He's an executive VP with the real estate brokerage firm CBRE. Roberts says Midtown's office vacancy rate is 27%, compared with 21% for the market overall. But they're trying to bring that down by showing potential tenants what
it's
could
literally
be.
Literally mullion glass, so, you know, ribbon glass all the way around the building.
Roberts and Mackey took me to a floor in the building that's been pretty much gutted. Just some columns with a concrete floor and windows lining the entire perimeter, which provided particularly spectacular 360-degree views of Phoenix. Roberts says when companies look at existing office space, they see the past. But when he can show them what basically amounts to an empty canvas?
We've actually done it three times. Every time we've done this to the floor, we've leased it.
Roberts says workspaces have evolved over time. Chris Mackey says getting more companies and jobs into these Midtown office buildings is one of her top priorities.
That urban heart of any city is what any city should pay the most attention to. And outside of downtown, Midtown is that area. And you get this area repopulated and people living and that vibrant economy down here, and it begins to spread out.
Mackey predicts in the next year to year and a half, the conversation about Midtown's vacancy rates will be a very different one, saying she expects to get that number below 20%, and part of the reason is right outside.
I think light rail has really opened that up for our companies and for site selectors and brokers to take a new look at what the Midtown market looks like.
Mackey says a couple of these buildings could ultimately be converted into housing, but most should stay as offices. But not everyone agrees with that plan. Louise Roman has lived at 1 Lexington on the corner of Central for about 5 years. It was converted from office space into condos. Roman is also head of the HOA's architecture committee and says she'd like to see all high-rise office buildings turned into places to live.
We really kind of think of it as a model for what could happen with a lot of the underutilized high-rises that are, especially in the Midtown area, that maybe even some combination of living and working would be desirable.
While many people in the area generally agree light rail is significant, many developers and even residents like Roman say there's more to do, especially with one particular spot in the neighborhood, Park Central. It was Phoenix's first shopping mall and now houses a few restaurants, but it's never bounced back to the level of patronage it once had. It's just a little south of where Roman lives. She calls it a missed opportunity.
It's the closest to kind of the downtown core that is without really enough going on it.
Roman says Park Central is a huge missing piece for the area, especially since it's between two light rail stops. But Park Central isn't the only part of Midtown that could use some TLC. There are some empty lots along Central in the neighborhood. Susan Thompson says they need to be filled in, but with the right kind of project.
If you're a developer, and if you're out there, please hear me. We want you here, but know your market. Why come here and build something that people are not interested in living in? It's going to fail.
Thompson says that means not trying to recreate the suburbs in one of Phoenix's central cores, but instead building off the neighborhood's urban feel. Our trip up Central Avenue continues next Thursday when we check out the area between Bethany Home and Northern. And in the meantime, there's a ton of stuff to check out online. Photos from along Central, interactive maps, a whole lot more. You can find it at kjzzcentral.tumblr.com. Warnings of moral decline are nothing new, but recently there's been an emphasis on the attempt to legislate morality. In the closing weeks of the state's legislative session, Senator Sylvia Allen expressed her concerns on the Senate floor.
How we get back to a moral rebirth in this country, I don't know, since we are slowly eroding religion at every opportunity that we have. Probably we should be debating a bill requiring every American to attend a church of their choice.
Allen later described that last part of the comment as flippant, but they came around the same time Indiana ignited a firestorm after quickly passing a Religious Freedom Restoration Act into law that could have ended up allowing for discrimination in the Hoosier state. While surveys from groups like Gallup and Pew find majorities of Americans agree we're losing our morality, no one seems to know what to do about it. Nancy Eisenberg deals with these issues every day as a professor of psychology at ASU. And Nancy, some like Senator Allen would recommend turning to the church while others have attempted to turn to the law, but can you really legislate morality?
No. You might even get reactants. People who don't want to go, you could have a negative effect, but I don't think you can legislate it anyway. Morality grows out of a lot of things that are happening, many of them early in life, and you can't legislate just by going to church or whatever, a lot of life, what's going on.
How important is it for kids to sort of get a basis in morality and sort of learn those lessons as kids, as opposed to trying to learn some of that stuff when you're maybe a teenager or an adult?
Well, values continue to change, and certainly the more cognitive aspects of values, some of them emerge at a later age. But I think a lot of morality is based on much more basic kind of responses, like caring about other people and the capacity for sympathy and empathy. And that's what's really often going to motivate moral behavior rather than some abstract knowledge of what's right and wrong. We gave up studying that abstract knowledge as the only predictor of morality a long time ago.
Is morality in some ways sort of in the eye of the beholder, what somebody thinks might be a moral act somebody else might disagree with?
Sure. And that's culturally relative to some degree, but even within a culture, I think the differences in perceptions of morality somewhat underlie different political conceptions. Certainly perspectives on morality vary dramatically. Most people will agree in the abstract that killing is wrong, but then you get into the details of under what circumstances you can kill someone else in a war, what aspects of war, et cetera, do you get differences? So, you know, there is considerable variation, even if on the surface it looks like there's a lot of consensus.
So given that, does it make it harder to sort of gauge whether or not society is moral, or we're living in a golden age of morality, or there's been some sort of devolution of morality?
Yeah, it does. And I think there's a distinction that people often fail to make that does also can lead to one perception or another. One can behave in kind of what we'd see as moral ways, like treat someone well, you know, help them, not hurt them, and do that just to the in group, people you know, your family, your neighbors, people like you, people in your church, whatever, but not act that way at all to people outside of one's group. And then there's some people who seem to apply their moral values more broadly to not just the people they have a direct connection with or like or care about, but to people who they don't even know. So it depends what you're looking at to some degree. If you're saying society is moral or not.
Nancy Eisenberg is Regents Professor of Psychology at ASU. Still to come, we hit another Valley Hot Corner. It's right around ASU, but it's not Mill Ave.
I do think that their biggest market is students from ASU, but I think they also want to draw in some residents who live here too. You know, there's a lot more residential in this Tempe area in the last couple of years that has come on.
That's ahead. It's the show. A bunch of problems on Valley freeways to be aware of, including the 60 westbound at Mill. There's a disabled vehicle blocking the center lane there. 101 southbound in the East Valley at Broadway, an accident there has the right lane blocked. I-10 eastbound at 16th Street, an accident blocking the shoulder. Also accidents I-10 westbound at 35th Avenue and I-10 eastbound at 59th Avenue.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, offering chef-prepared dinners, specialty meats, fine wines, and desserts for spring celebrations. 10 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. The Labor Department's March employment report proved surprisingly soft at 126,000 jobs created. Steve Beckner of Market News International says this could affect the direction of interest rates.
Fed officials and Fed watchers had been wondering whether recent slower economic growth would lead to smaller job gains or whether GDP growth would rebound and sustain strong employment. For now, the answer seems to be that sluggish growth is being mirrored in the labor market. Although the unemployment rate stayed at 5.5%, non-farm payrolls grew by less than half what they had been averaging. Some analysts think the soft numbers increase odds the Fed will wait until September to start raising interest rates from zero. But others still see a good chance of a June rate hike. For NPR News, I'm Steve Beckner.
President Obama is working to assure Congress that a framework nuclear deal with Iran is sound. Iran's political establishment has embraced it, but Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu is not pleased, and he's asking for a stipulation that Iran recognize Israel's right to exist. State Department spokeswoman Marie Harf told reporters the nuclear deal is narrow in focus.
This is an agreement that is only about the nuclear issue. We have purposefully kept that separate from every other issue. That issue is complicated enough to deal with on its own. No, this is an agreement that doesn't deal with any other issues, nor should it.
Congress is expected to begin debate of the plan after spring recess, although the deal would not be subject to congressional approval. In a court filing today, the Justice Department stated that an inmate's gender identity challenges must be respected and treated by prison officials just as any other medical or mental health condition. The filing relates to the case of a transgender woman in prison in the state of Georgia. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Mark Brody. Ken Ford is one of the few scientists left from the days of the H-bomb era, the superbomb that was essentially the Cold War upgrade to the bombs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The thermonuclear H-bomb created the doctrine of mutually assured destruction, so unimaginably destructive that its use would equal defeat for the nation that used it and the world itself. Ken Ford's book, Building the H-Bomb, A Personal History, chronicles his younger days working on the bomb and the first test of the hydrogen bomb on a Pacific island that was all but destroyed by a blast in 1952.
In my considered opinion, he wrote, this book contains nothing whose dissemination could possibly harm the United States or help some other country seeking to design and build an H-bomb. The last thing Ford expected was that his story would produce a secrecy problem with his own government. This 88-year-old physics wizard has had to brush up on his legal definitions of top secret and Q clearances to keep the U.S. government from censoring his memoir, which is a part of American history.
That comes down to what they define as restricted data, capital R, capital D, restricted data. That's a categorization of weapons-related information. I think of it as a tablet up there in the sky on which is engraved all of this information about nuclear weapons, much of which, in the meantime, has in fact been released by such people with authoritative backgrounds. So what we have is really a catch-22 situation in which some of this data exists both simultaneously, both as secret information and as public information. And because I did have Q clearance and because I did have access to weapons information, I'm denied, according to the Department of Energy, I'm denied the opportunity to reveal any restricted data, even if others have authoritatively revealed it before me.
How frustrating has this been?
It's been quite frustrating. And the interesting thing is that I never imagined that I would even need to submit my manuscript to the Department of Energy for review. I had finished a manuscript by June of last year, 2014, and was all set to start dealing with the publisher and making small corrections to refine it. And an acquaintance of mine at the Department of Energy said to me, you know, Ken, you really ought to submit that review to the Department of Energy for a review. Well, it hadn't occurred to me that that would be necessary because I didn't think there was anything conceivably in it that could conceivably harm the United States. However, I acceded to his suggestion. I did submit it. And then it's been not a nightmare, but it's been a very difficult period of many months that have gone by since I submitted to them, initially in the expectation that it would take only 2 or 3 weeks for them to complete the review. Well, more than 6 months have passed, and they submitted to me in November a list of 60 different items in the book that I should remove, and it was made plain to me that these were not suggestions that I removed them, they were directives. I was required to remove them. Well, those 60 items added up to about the equivalent of about 20 pages of a 200-page book, about 10% of the book. And I was able to respond in detail to each of those 60, stating in at least 57 of the instances why I did not think it was appropriate or necessary to delete the material. So we've had a bit of back and forth on that. Finally, we reached an impasse in January of this year, and I just simply gave up and said, well, since I know and am absolutely sure in my own mind that there's nothing in here that could possibly harm the United States or help some rogue nation trying to build an H-bomb, I'm going to go ahead and publish, and I did.
What do you think is the easy fix here to just move on and get an important historical story told and to get the government off your back?
Well, I can think of three things that the Department of Energy could do that would achieve that end. One is they could simply declassify my book. They could say, okay, your book contains secrets, but we recognize that those are not secrets whose publication could possibly harm the United States, and therefore we are going to declassify your book. That's one possibility, and I've strongly recommended to them that they consider that. Another thing they could do is simply remove material in the restricted data category that doesn't belong there, material that has entered the public domain and should have been erased from the restricted data category but has not yet been erased. So that's a second possibility. The third possibility for them, which would be leave me in a little bit of an uneasy state, is simply that they would do nothing. They could say, well, we didn't want that book published, but it is published. And if we go after Ken Ford, we recognize that the result is only will be that he'll sell more books. So it's possible that they'll just choose to do nothing.
Ken, you're a young 88, right?
That's correct.
Do you think that in your lifetime you will see an H-bomb used in a military operation for one reason or another, even by accident or intentionally? What do you think?
I think not. We've gone 70 years without using nuclear weapons, and thank God. The goal, certainly, expressed by President Obama and no doubt held by leaders throughout the world, the goal is zero nuclear weapons in the world. That certainly won't happen in my lifetime. It probably won't happen in the lifetime of my children. But perhaps by the end of this century, it is certainly a goal worth pursuing. And I am optimistic that any nation that possesses nuclear weapons would realize it's very counterproductive to use them, that there's no real good reason to use them, and therefore that we might remain a world free of the use of nuclear weapons for a long time to come, and eventually even a world free of stored and available nuclear weapons.
Ken Ford, a physicist and author of 10 books on science. His latest book is a memoir entitled Building the H-Bomb, A Personal Story, a book that the government has some problems with, something we've been discussing. Ken Ford, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
More than 40 million acres in the western U.S. have been affected by bark beetles. The insects have been blamed for attacking trees already weakened by drought. That, in turn, has made the trees more susceptible in wildfire season, which is just around the corner. At Northern Arizona University, entomologist and assistant professor Rich Hofstetter has been working on methods to eliminate bark beetles. Several years ago, he experimented with using acoustics, in particular rock music, to limit the beetles' reproduction. Now he's turned to a fungus that may kill the beetles.
So we've seen dead bark beetles under the bark, and it appears to have been a result of some kind of microbe, particularly a fungus or bacteria. We often don't know what these agents are that kill bark beetles. But one of the better known pathogens of bark beetles is Bavaria bassiana, which is the fungus that we're currently working on. Several years ago, I was contacted by Cliff Bradley of Bioagriculture Inc. out of Montana, who specializes in insect pathogens and has had a lot of experience there, particularly in agriculture. And he actually approached me to pursue this idea in forest pests, and this has never been pursued in forests. It's quite common practice in agriculture, but hasn't been worked on in forest systems. The idea then is to use this bioinsecticide, and so this is a natural pathogen of bark beetles that's simply used as an sort of like an insecticide that you would spray, but it's a biological agent that's naturally found in our environment.
Is there any concern that that would affect the environment in any greater way?
There is. And, you know, whenever you're putting anything in the environment, you want to make sure there's minimal impacts. We are studying how the fungus affects non-target organisms. We have pretty strong evidence and years of knowledge that this Bavaria bassiana does not affect vertebrates in any way. So woodpeckers and raccoons and squirrels and other things in the environment have no impact at all from this fungus. We are looking at what the fungus would do to other insects. This is a fungus found throughout the world, this particular species. However, each strain of the fungus is unique in how it affects, you know, potentially one species or multiple species, or even insects within a particular order or across borders. The fungi we are looking at appear to only affect bark beetles in particular, and so we're targeting those strains of this species of fungus.
If things work as you hope they would, what does success look like?
The ability to use alternative, environmentally friendly tool to reduce beetle populations and also to protect living trees from bark beetle attack. If you could successfully apply this fungus to a healthy tree and protect it from bark beetle attack. And also in instances where we're thinning forests, if you could apply it to the slash material, the remaining cut material to reduce bark beetle populations and eliminate potential movement into standing trees, that would be a success.
Entomologist Rich Hofstetter is an associate professor in the School of Forestry. We've been talking about his work in trying to eliminate the bark beetle population that has been destroying trees in northern Arizona and other places, increasing the risk of wildfires. Rich, thank you for the time.
Thank you.
When you see a work of art, how do you know if you like it? Is it the color, the size, or does it just have a certain je ne sais quoi?
Voices stretched thin in pale sun, empty visions cluttering the space behind the eye.
That's Jack Evans. He wrote this poem to describe what he feels when he looks at a 1938 painting titled American Landscape.
Dreams stacked on pallets rust inside the storm walls of blinded weather.
Evans is reading in the Phoenix Art Museum, standing right next to the subject of his poem.
The arrow of old promises points to barbed wire shards of light dancing on afternoon air.
It's art celebrating art, like a movie about movie making or a song about singing. But the point is to add another layer to the museum experience.
Like, it's one thing to see it on a wall and to read a plaque, and it's another to actually hear a person read about it and interpret it.
Jake Friedman is the founder of the literary magazine Four Chambers Press. It put out a call for submissions for poetry and prose about artwork in the museum and then published some of them. But Four Chambers staff wanted to connect the writers with the artwork and other museum visitors. So they created a museum tour of sorts. Each stop is a reading at the very location where that writer got their inspiration. For Allegra Hyde, it was Louise Nevelson's Royal Tide 5.
Well, it's a group of wooden boxes with table legs and wooden shards, and it's almost actually hard to tell what is in here.
Still, the abstract sculpture fed Hyde's imagination.
The apartment swallowed things, always hungry, like the insides of a clock.
You might look at one of the larger-than-life artworks in a museum and think, wow, I could never make that. But Friedman says we all have the power to create our own interpretation.
So the people who are in front of you don't have any specific expertise. They're just telling you about their experience. And that is a way for us to connect both with the piece of art and the person who's reading it and to build community.
You can join the walking tour tomorrow afternoon at 2:30. And hey, maybe you'll be inspired to write a song about the poems, about the art. Still with me? You can find more details at theshow.kjzz.org. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Quick check of traffic. 101 southbound, the right lane is blocked at Broadway by an accident. US 60 westbound, a disabled vehicle at Mill blocks the center lane. And I-10 westbound, there's an accident at 35th Avenue. If you've missed any of the segments of our Central Avenue series or just want to see some photos or hear it again, you can check it all out. It's on the web, kjzzcentral.tumblr.com. That's kjzzcentral.tumblr.com.
KJZZ is supported by the Musical Instrument Museum, celebrating Middle Eastern music with live musical performances, hands-on activities, dancing, and more. Saturday and Sunday, April 11th and 12th. More at mim.org.
We head now to another hot corner, spots around the valley with a lot going on. As always, let's meet our tour guide.
I'm Gwen Ashley Walters, and I'm a food journalist. I write for Phoenix Magazine.
And where are we?
We are on College Avenue in Tempe.
On the corner of College and 5th Street, to be precise, just a tight spiral from Sun Devil Stadium. And Gwen says this is more than just a hot corner.
It's more of actually a little block here. We've got about
a hot block.
Three short blocks of some really new, exciting eateries that have come on board in the last couple years.
Like what?
Well, there is a brand new place to open called Nush, and it's kind of a Euro-Persian restaurant. Very cool space.
And we're sitting at a Royal Coffee Bar. They have several locations throughout the valley, but this one in downtown Tempe.
This is the third one, and this one opened about a year ago? Pretty close to a year ago, I think. So.
And just looking across the street and down as I walked up this way, this street is just lined with places to eat and drink.
It's hopping. It's hopping right now. And I would say maybe the very first one was a Paradise Hawaiian Barbecue, and that they opened in 2008. And then I don't think anything happened for a while. But now life is coming back to the street. A lot of eateries are moving into this space. It's going to be a little mini mill.
So why do you think it is that all of a sudden this area has sort of sprung up and become kind of a cool, hip place to be?
I think the university really wanted a little walking, pedestrian, safe place for them. They opened a big commons area, and I think they really just wanted to have another space for people to come and walk and eat and stay and play.
Well, just looking across the street, there's a Jimmy John's, there's a Dickie's barbecue, there's a donut place down the other corner.
Mm-hmm. Right,
so
exactly.
It seems like these are all sort of either like not fast food, but sort of like quick food, like something you might be able to get in between
right.
classes, for example.
Well, we are close to the university, and so I do think that their biggest market is students from ASU, but I think they also want to draw in some residents who live here too. You know, there's a lot more residential in this Tempe area in the last couple of years that has come on.
It seems like this would be a good selling point for ASU to have a place like this in addition to what's going on over on Mill.
Absolutely. I think that's really one of the reasons why they wanted to develop this little stretch here. And it really is three short blocks, and there are tons of independents mixed in with some chain restaurants. So you do have, I think there's something for everyone on this little street, this little block right here. One thing we didn't talk about opening is Nokowich. And inside Nokowich is going to be the donut dispensary. So there's going to be a local donut shop. The one that you mentioned on the corner is a chain, but we're going to have a local option for donuts at the donut dispensary by Elliot Wexler.
Can never have too many donuts near a university campus, right?
Absolutely not.
Or just in life.
Exactly. You got to have a donut. Plus his sandwiches, his gourmet sandwiches are just off the chart.
How do you think what's going on here relates to what's going on a little bit further west on Mill?
On Mill. Mill has been there forever, and I think that there's less independence there than there probably was maybe 10 years ago. So it seems like maybe they've kind of moved over here, and this is the new area, and this is where you want to be.
I mean, would you consider them in competition?
No, because I think there's so many people down here. Plus, now with a light rail, they can
bring, we just heard,
yeah, we just heard it. You can bring so many more people right to here, and I think there's something for everyone. I don't think you're going to get rid of that Mill Avenue. It is kind of a party central street that's been here forever. I think this one is just newer. It's shorter. There's a mix of chains and independents, and there's the school functions that are here, the commons is here. So I think, the president's office is right down on the corner at the Fulton Center. So I think there's just a little something for everybody. And I think they can coexist right next to each other.
In the overall universe of restaurant scene in the Valley, where does Tempe stand? I mean, how is Tempe considered as far as a restaurant area?
Well, I think it still has a little bit of that, it's a college town, so you're going to have a lot of burgers and pizza joints, right? But I do think that people are trying to bring a little more sophistication to this area. And if you think about it, the students, the ASU attracts all kinds of students. And plus, where are all the professors going to eat, right?
Are there particular types of foods or types of restaurants that you generally see around universities that maybe the ones around here play into, maybe they don't?
Well, sure you do. There's a couple pizza places right on this strip, and then the barbecue place. Those are going to attract students. But I think now with Pocino coming and Nokowich and this new place, Nush, I think these are bringing a little bit more sophistication than the typical burger and pizza places.
Gwen Ashley Walters is a food journalist writing for Phoenix Magazine. We met on the corner of College and Fifth Street in Tempe. The Cactus League was formed in the late 1940s, but that wasn't Arizona's introduction to baseball. America's pastime in this state goes back much farther than that. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez takes us through time.
Since 1947, fans flocked to Arizona for a bit of baseball under the warm spring sun. But did you know spring training has been part of Arizona for more than 100 years?
The earliest spring game for a major league team in Arizona was in 1909.
in Yuma.
Rodney Johnson is an official scorer for Major League Baseball and president of the Society for American Baseball Research in Arizona. Sitting in empty Tempe Diablo Stadium, he recalls Arizona's baseball history.
The White Sox came through on their way back from spring training in California and made a train stop in Yuma. The game was part of the opening of the Laguna Dam celebration for the city of Yuma.
Johnson says this was the first spring training game for a major league team in Arizona. This exhibition game opened the doors for other teams to do the same.
A lot of baseball teams, they had their spring training in California, and the way they made their way back to their home states, to Chicago, to New York, to Cleveland, was by train. And on those train trips, they stopped at whistle stops to play ball games, exhibitions, and Arizona was a frequent stop.
Trains stopped in Yuma, Bisbee, Douglas, and Tucson. Johnson says this was Arizona's first formal introduction to big league baseball. But it wasn't until 1929 when a major league team decided to make Arizona its spring training site.
As far as spring training goes, no team other than the 1929 Tigers actually came here and set up camp and had spring training camp here.
The Tigers only played a couple of games. Johnson says it was the minor leagues that set Arizona on a permanent baseball path.
The first minor league to be in Arizona was the Rio Grande Valley Association, which was 1916. And they had teams in Phoenix and Tucson, and as well as El Paso and Albuquerque and Las Cruces.
Although the Rio Grande Valley Association League ended after 59 games, other leagues followed. The Arizona State League in 1929 and later the Arizona Texas League. World War II limited baseball teams' travel. But when it ended, baseball was on the move again, and the Cactus League was born here in Arizona. With so much baseball history, it took Arizona more than 90 years to have its own major league team. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or know things that we ought to know, please tell us about them. The show at KJZZ.org. Plenty of good stuff to do this weekend if you want to catch some Cactus League baseball. Time, though, is running out. This is the last weekend. The D-backs, though, do open their season against the San Francisco Giants Monday night at Chase Field. Also this weekend, you can check out the Magic of Manilow tribute. That's at Wild Horse Pass and Casino. And Leon Russell, the blues legend, will be performing Saturday night at Talking Stick Resort. The show was produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer, Sky Shout, and Maria Springs are the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias, our executive producer, John Hoban. If you've missed any of our Central Avenue series so far, or just want to see a whole lot more photos and hear some more cool stuff, check it out, kjzzcentral.tumblr.com. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks so much for listening. It's 3 o'clock.